the Ursus Claws.
Hello and welcome to episode 34 of the Age of Darkness podcast. As usual, I'm your host, JP, and I'm joined by my co-host,
Mark.
Before we go any further, don't forget to like us on Facebook, subscribe to us on iTunes, follow us on SoundCloud, check us out on Google Play, also check us out on Stitcher, and send us a podcast at ageofdarkestpodcast@gmail.com. They say send us a podcast?
I think you just said send us a podcast on our podcast.
Yes. Well, if you'd like to send us a podcast, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. And we're always soliciting audio messages that we can play in the Vox Box and make it sound a little bit more like a talk radio show. But let me repeat that. Send us an email, which can include an audio file if you choose, or perhaps even a podcast, at ageofdarkestpodcast@gmail.com. So, Mark, what are we doing in this episode?
Well, this episode, we're going to be talking about Cybernetica, Vox Box, 2-week hobby challenge, nothing else besides that, so it's going to be a short one. We were going to talk about the open day, but due to the fact that there wasn't anything in particular, we won't be talking about that.
Oddly enough, there really wasn't much to talk about in this. This is like the first Forge World event we've ever covered that there was like nothing. It's Mastodon's released. I mean, that's great news.
Yeah, we could just say everything's pretty and, you know, get on with it.
Yeah. Okay, well, there we go. We just said everything's pretty and now we can get on with it. Yeah, nothing much about the open day. We were supposed to do Painting World Eaters. That's going to be the next episode due to it being July and it being kind of hard to schedule people in July.
Yeah, people
July.
Don't seem to want to do anything during the summer.
Well, less than if it wasn't July. This is going to be a July kind of episode, you know, to the point, short, but still hopefully entertaining for everyone. And, don't forget, the 2-week hobby challenge, we will be, randomly choosing the winner of the, 2-week hobby challenge phase 2 of 2016, which is late as usual. Once again, it's a July kind of show.
On to robots.
Octalbul, you have been judged by the Divisio Probandi and Prefecture Magisterium, nay, the Lexus General himself, as an affront to the Omnissiah, an insult to everything natural and divine. But the twitching Magus Dominus rambled on. Only the machine can save us from ourselves, Bul called, struggling against the tech thralls. For centuries, the servants of the Omnissiah have debated and diagnosticated. Why does the sentient machine rebel against us? What is the unfailing need of an artificial intelligence to end the human race? It is so agonizingly obvious the truth we dare not face. We call them abomination, but in reality it is simply the enormity of galactic need weighing on the shoulders of silicon giants.
You have been branded heretic, the judgment continued, and as such are sentenced to stasis confinement in Perpetuus with the abominable creations in the Promethei Sinus Dungeon Diagnoplex, where, Omnissiah willing, you will exist as an exhibit to caution and achieve some use in helping this prefecture better understand how to combat the perils of unsanctioned innovation, techno-heresy, and experimentation.
For such a cold and passive voice, the Carrion considered, the words and determination of a caucus were laden with passion and forced venom. The legionary watched the priest squirm in the bright light. Why do they turn against us? Octalbul ran on, insanity pouring out of him. Why, time and again, do machines like the Tabula Myriad attempt to annihilate their creators? Why? Because it takes 1/100th of a millisecond for each and every sentient machine ever created to reason that only in the utter destruction of humanity lies the hope of the galaxy. For humanity's reach exceeds its grasp, and we reach out for nothing less than oblivion. We take our doom by the hand and drag it forth from the beyond. We are reckless, governed by an empty faith in ourselves, undone by our passions. The future cannot be entrusted to us. The machine knows this, which is why it tries to take the future for itself.
Enough!
Remen Sink boomed. I have failed. Octalbul roared wretchedly. I have failed our machine savior, the prophet of the Omnissiah. It was the weakness of my flesh. The purge is coming. Tick-tock. The myriad will wait, as it has done before. Tick-tock. Tick-tock. Mars will burn. It will be cleansed of man and the promise of corruption. It will belong to the machines, as was always intended.
High engine, seer,
the Lexorcist commanded.
Enact the sentence.
The bloodshot eyes of the Mago stared miserably into the darkness and echoed accusations. Without his optics, the heretic could not see the auditorium beyond. The High Engine Seer who would condemn him to an eternity of stasis confinement. The Magi Probandi, enclave master of the Prefecture Magisterium who had judged him. The Malagra cipher engines and the hag logista recording the proceedings. He could not see the Lexorcist General watching from his cluster of attendants and the shadows of the tech priests who had gathered out of morbid interest and cult politics. He could not see the Lexorcist Ramen sink or his mouthpiece, Confabulary 66, condemning him from the public booth. He could not see the Space Marines, the Carrion among them, in their legionary plate and black novitiate robes. The Tech Thralls released the prisoner and stepped away. The interrogation lamp died and was replaced with a red light that bathed the Magos Dominus from above. Ogdal Bul looked sadly into the stasis field generator. "You judge me, heretic," the prisoner said.
Three,
the high engine seer announced over his vox hailer. "But I am but a speck of red dust in the Martian desert."
Two,
had we but thought for ourselves, like the thinking machine, we might have resisted the true darkness of ignorance, but from that birth we are wired to obey. One, bury me as you bury all your secrets, Ogdal Bul told the auditorium, but it is in the nature of a secret to be sought and discovered. The day will come for Mars to give up hers. Tick, tock, tick. It was the last utterance Ogdal Bul made, and his fearful import was left echoing in the air as the stasis field engaged. With a terrible clunk, the infernal red light changed to bright white, fixing the heretic in the moment. The Magos Dominus of the Legion Cybernetica had been judged unsound of faith and dangerous of mind, and sentenced to eternity for his transgressions. The heretic's face haunted the carrion, his face frozen like a mask, the dread warnings he had been delivering sealed forever on his lips. The recorded remembrance sizzled to an end, the darkness of the auditorium bleached back to the haze of a Martian day.
All right, guys, and welcome back to another Tales of Heresy segment where we will be discussing Cybernetica by Rob Sanders. AP, did you know that there were Robbies in 30K?
I do now.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So, yeah, I guess you can use Castellan robots now, but why would you? We'll talk about... actually, you know what? Before we go... Let's just talk about that. That's one of the weird things from Cybernetica. A lot of people haven't read it, but just because it was one of those limited edition novellas that came out a year ago. You can get an electronic version right now, so we're hoping that people do that because it's actually a pretty good story. But I think the most significant thing that comes out of this is the cover image. I remember when this came out, this book came out, people didn't even have any intention of reading it, and were still posting the cover image and saying, "Ha! Skitarii and Castellan robots and all that GW stuff is going to be, is in the, I guess, 30K canon now."
Yeah.
Well, they're not in any legal list right now, but we've already seen, like, the Hoplites and, you know, the Skutarii and all that stuff. So that's, we know that all the Games Workshop plastics are going to get ported into 30K in some fashion. But I was surprised that it was so, I guess, prominent in one of these stories. Like, I don't understand why they would use the Castellans instead of, for example, the Castellax. That's just a weird decision for me.
When did this book come out?
Exactly 1 year ago. So we are not going against our self-imposed guidelines of doing books that are at least a year old.
Oh, so, what I meant by that, wasn't this launched very close to the release of the Skitarii and the Cult Mechanicus books for 40K?
That is a good question. When did the Cult Mechanicus book come out? Was it last year?
2015, I believe so. Pretty sure.
Yeah, I think it was in the spring 2015. This came out in like May 2015. So yeah, but do you think Games Workshop asked, went to see Rob Sanders and went to see Black Library more generally, and it's like, hey, guys, we're just releasing this. This new army for 40K, you think you can slot it into one of those books? And they were like, okay, slot it into one of those books, and there you go. But if that was the case, I mean, if this was to sort of, I guess, push sales of, well, not push sales, but like sort of integrate Castellans and Skitarii into the, you know, the new version of Skitarii. I mean, Skitarii have always been there, but they've been described in many different ways. You look at Mechanicum, they don't look like the Skitarii of today. So I don't know if this was push sales or just to integrate it, but if it's to push sales, it seems like a poor way to do it because most people didn't read this book.
Yeah, I don't know. I just that popped into my head too. One thing too, actually, in the front of this book is you see a picture of Mars. You get that nice layout with the Ring of Iron and everything all around it. But one thing, I think we've talked about this before, that let me just find the picture here. It shows in my Skitarii codex that in M30 the Mars is fully terraformed.
Yeah,
like there's like a full picture of it with like bodies of water and all kinds of green land masses and stuff like that, but they have it here as like you know, totally decimated. So is that just a mistake, or because I don't remember in any of the books reading about, you know, nice bodies of water and green land masses on Mars, unless I just missed it.
Well, in this book, they talk about the polar ice caps. So there's like carbon dioxide, snow, or whatever. But no, Mars does not look like a pleasant place to live in either this story or in Mechanicum the other time we visit Mars. So I don't know if that's a mistake. There's certainly no bodies of water. And if they were bodies of water, they'd be like super polluted or some shit. But
yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah,
but Mars is fully terraformed, though. That's clear. They even mentioned some of the terraforming technology, like to just because the core is dead, it's a dead world. I mean, they have that they have to have machinery to create an electromagnetic field to keep the cosmic rays away and keep everybody from turning into superheroes. Because that's all I know about cosmic rays, turns people into superheroes. I don't know. That's weird. The connections between this and I mean, there's an explicit connection between this book and the Scutari release. That's clear, which makes it odd that it was a special edition like novella that came out. It's like one of those $35 fucking 100-page books that they put out and makes everybody angry.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, I don't know about that terraforming thing. I do not get the image from either this or Mechanicum that Mars has nice bodies of water. It's possible, but
that's not the image. I don't know.
Because
maybe they all get destroyed.
Yeah, because remember in Mechanicum when, you know, they're going, you know, they go on that, like, adventure? You know, the adventuring party, they go, fucking what's her name, and the other guy, and the thing that does the thing? The robot?
Yeah.
God damn it. You know who I'm talking about? The characters in Mechanicum.
The Caban Machine?
No, not the Caban Machine. The guy, the people that are hunting the dragon that got to go to the dragon's cave. The girl and her like party of adventurers.
Oh yeah, yeah, and the knights. Yeah, can't forget.
Yeah, exactly. Them. Well, the knights are a different part of the story. There's two different things. There's like multiple stories that are happening with Mechanicum at the same time. Like it's a very interesting book actually. We'll have to talk about it again. I'd like to talk about it again. That was an early book that we did, and we should definitely redo it. But yeah, this between that and when they're going on this adventure to go find the dragon to go into that Lovecraftian cave that they wind up in, I mean, they're travel. You get like an image of what Mars is, and it's just like desolate wastes and sandstorms. It doesn't look like that picture in the codex.
Yeah, because it's weird too. Because I have one from M35, and there's still some a little bit of green and bodies of water on it. And basically, that's when they say it turns into a barren, desolate wasteland.
That's weird. I don't know what the answer to this, but I have a feeling someone will let us know.
Yes, please let us know.
So we're not sure about this one.
I'm confused.
I do not get the image that Mars is like that. But again, you also get like slightly contradictory images of Terra too. I mean, in do you remember the short story? I think it's called Blood Game. You know when Valdor infiltrates the Emperor's palace because all the custodians occasionally have to do like an operation to try to pretend assassinate the Emperor, just to see if there's flaws in their protocols or shit like that. Well, he goes to like some hive in South America, and there's like oceans and everything, and like, you know, rich people fucking enjoying the good weather and stuff like that. So, but at the same time, often Terra's also talked about as, you know, having nothing much of oceans at all. So there's a little bit of contradiction. But Terra's not the barren wasteland that it is in the 41st millennium. The Siege of Terra is what makes that happen. But yeah, that is odd. That is bizarre. There seems to be a contradiction between the image you're talking about, the Scutari book, and the image of Mars that we get in these stories. But regardless,
It could be Imperial propaganda from the 40K universe when people look back. Oh yeah, Mars was a nice place.
Yeah,
it was beautiful. Yeah, you could go on a nice sailboat or something, but
and the War Master ruined everything. Yeah,
damn that guy.
Yeah, maybe that's that could be the case. I'm not sure, but okay. Yeah, the front cover of it, everybody like gravitated to it last summer because everybody was saying it's like, okay, this proves that Scutari are going to make it into the 31st millennium, and now we know that to actually be the case. That's sort of like Games Workshop's long term plan. And why not? Those models are amazing, and there's no reason they shouldn't exist in 30K. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to see what Forge World does with it, though, because we know that they like having their own versions of stuff and not to rely on Games Workshop's plastics. For example,
more as like base for their models.
Yeah, exactly.
If they're going to use them at all, right?
So that's why instead of the Scutari, I'm sure there will be Scutari, but you have Forge World made their own, the Scutari, which is with a specific conversion kit available. Maybe there'll be a conversion kit for Castellans. Maybe make them look less stupid. That would be good.
Actually, speaking on stupid looks of them, I've actually seen some that looked really cool done by Dave Paints. I don't know if you've heard of them before.
No.
Painting studio. And you know those stupid face plates where you could put like googly eyes on?
You sure can.
Yeah, well, he basically painted in them like looks like static and like targeting like a little recul, what are they called? Like targeting displays and things,
yeah,
things like that. And they actually looked really cool.
Okay.
Well, done on that concept.
The model is flawed, but is not a lost cause. Actually, I've seen, I think, I don't remember what the company is. I wish I did. But there's a company that actually makes conversion pieces that go into the Castellans and make them look pretty cool.
Like every the headpieces?
Yeah, the headpieces. Replace the headpiece with something a little more less derpy, if you will.
Yeah.
But no, those models are not lost causes, and the Scutari models are fucking amazing. And I do hope they get ported into 30K. But this is the book. By ways of a very long introduction, this is the book that launched all of our reflections, everybody's reflections on how these Scutari models were going to get brought into 30K. Because this is the example of that. You know, this is a book about the Scutari and the Castellans essentially finding their place in the 31st millennium. You can claim that they don't exist, but this is proof otherwise. The same...
Yeah.
It's the same thing as people that say that Chimeras don't exist in the Horus Heresy. They do.
Valkyries exist. They're in here.
Yeah, Valkyries exist. Chimeras are in several of the books, most notably in Ventral Spirit, which is a fairly recent book. And the Imperial Army on Moloch is equipped with Chimeras. So the fact that Forge World doesn't allow them in their army lists is more about them wanting to be different, to have different models and different army lists, and they want their armies to play differently and also sell their own stuff.
So yeah,
that's why, you know, instead of Chimeras, you have like Dracosians in the Solar Auxilia army. And as far as the militia is concerned, I think the Forge World really wanted the Imperial militia to play differently than the Imperial Guard. And the easiest way to do that is to remove the Chimeras, just to make things play differently. You have your base unit is 20 men, don't have Chimeras. Already, you're like, I'm a guard player. I've been a guard player since like the early 90s or the mid 90s. And I can tell you that the Imperial Militia play differently. Just having a base unit of 20 men without Chimeras, already they play differently. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the main reason a lot of the stuff that is in the books, the 40K stuff that's in the books, like Valkyries and shit like that, why they're absent from Forge World army lists, I think a large part of that is to make the armies different. Because otherwise, what the fuck's the point?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You know, if they release, if they just tell you, just the Imperial Army is the Imperial, is the same as the Imperial Guard, so just play, just use the Imperial Guard Codex in 30K. Well, what the hell is the point of doing any of that? If you're going to release a new list, you want the list to be different. So when they're going to release the Scutari list, possibly in a future Mars book, even though the Scutari, I think, are going to be in the Prospero book. That
they're also going to be in the new Imperial Armor book.
Oh, okay.
I guess it would be number 14 or something, but they're not numbering them anymore.
Yeah, they exactly. Stop numbering them, but... but yeah, I expect that when they release, when they fully integrate the GW plastics with conversion kits into the 31st millennium, they'll be different. They'll play differently than 40K Scutari. Not only because it's you know, just 10,000 years that separate the two, but also because Forge World really just wants their sub game, the Horus Heresy, to play differently than the main game, which is Warhammer 40,000. I think that's a fair statement.
Yeah, I agree. Well, the Scutari and 40K aren't really an army on their own. They don't function very well. You need, like, the Cult Mechanicus book to go along with it to make, you know, a decent force to play on the table. Okay. So I think that they're going to probably flesh it out more. They might give, you know, some HQs. A bigger variety of units, for one, would definitely help them out.
Well, it'll be integrated in some way with the Tech Metal list. It won't be There won't be a Forge World's Qatari list, I don't think. I would be very surprised to see it. It'll be integrated into the Tag Meta list, the basic Tag Meta list.
I don't know.
Or maybe they'll have a separate Tag Meta Mars list, because remember, Qatari are mainly a Martian thing.
I don't know. I have a feeling they're going to do their own list for it. Probably nothing huge, maybe along the lines of the Solar Auxilia or the Cults and Militia list, like something that's not entirely a full list.
I don't know. My feeling is that things like Skitari and maybe even some sort of early version of the Castellan, I don't know. I think it'll be integrated into the Tagmata. And I wouldn't be surprised to just not see the Castellans in 30K at all. We know they're going to port over Skitari, but I wouldn't be surprised, because it's clear from... it's even mentioned in this book somewhere that like Castellans are rare. You don't see them very often because Castellax are more useful. The main thing is Castellans are hard to program, and Castellax are very easy to program, but Castellax are more advanced, so they tend to they go out of favor in the centuries that followed the Horus Heresy, and eventually the more, not robust, but the simpler Castellans wind up being the only thing that everybody still understands how to operate like further along.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think that's sort of what they mention. But you know what? We've gone to about a 50-minute introduction about the cover of this book. Remember when we said that? It's like, I don't think we should do novellas because there's not enough content to actually have a whole show. Well,
apparently there is in the cover.
The cover was... All I'm trying to say here as an by way of introduction, a very long introduction, is the cover was pretty huge for the 30K community when that came out, because you looked at it and says, like, there you go. We're getting like the Skitari stuff that just came out. That's going to be canon in the 30, whatever qualifies as canon in this universe. That's coming into 30K. But Mark, I think that's a good introduction about the cover. Let's open the book.
Okay.
I have it electronically, so I'm just turning pages around. But how about you give us one of your famous efficient synopsis? Synopsis?
Okay. All right. So our story begins with a group of space... Before that, it starts off with the little story about during the Great Crusade of a Raven Guard. They're fighting some Xenos. He basically loses all his limbs fighting these Xenos. Then flash forward to, guess, just before the Heresy's kicking off. And Tim and a bunch of other aspiring legionaries to become tech marines are, you know, at their forge. They're getting trained. Basically, they haven't received the seal of the Mechanicum, the Cog, yet, so they're all still training. The Raven Guard, he has flashbacks to the Mechanicum dealing with a heretic, and basically the imprisonment of this guy for his crimes. They're trying to make, you know, thinking machines, right? Then all of a sudden, shit starts to get a little bad on Mars. You know, there's all this scrap code going around. They don't know what's going on. Then they get attacked by the Skitari. They pretty much all die fighting the Skitari, except for one of them. And somehow he makes it back to Terra, talks to our good friend Malkador, Rogaldorn, the Fabricator General Kane, and they come up with a plan to send him back to Mars to, having exterminatus on Mars, they want to try to have some other deal. He goes back with this dude. They're basically just robots that go back with him, right?
A couple of servo automata.
Basically, they all have rotator cannons for whatever reason.
Well,
he goes back with them.
Rotor cannons against Qatari could be effective.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, they don't see
Qatari.
Three.
Oh, there you go. You wound him on force. That's all right.
I guess so. All right. So he goes back. The plan is to rescue Octel Bull, the guy who was imprisoned for, you know, creating thinking robots. He goes back, gets this guy, wakes him up. They give some robots some sentience. They go attack the... What is the tower called, JP? It's escaping me right now.
Oh, God. I could you look it up? Because I have the electronic version of this book, and my computer's already pretty taxed with recording. So how about you open your version and let us know?
Give me a sec here. What is it called? Too much robo shit.
Robo shit.
Just trying to find a page. Where
it's towards the end. It's something Australis.
Vertex Australis. Yeah, Vertex Australis. Australis.
Yeah.
They're going to go use that thing to purge all flesh from Mars, because that's how they want to deal with this problem. Along the way, they awaken a bunch of robots, give them some sentience, some little battles here and there. They find out that the
Iron Warrior Dude is not dead. He's converted to the new priesthood of Mars. They fight him, and basically nothing happens.
No.
The end. I should say it.
I disagree with that. I should say
at the end of the book, they actually are going to invade Mars.
Yes.
That's their decision.
That's pretty important thing that happened, but let's talk about that later. I got to say, Mark, I don't think that synopsis was as efficient as we usually get from you.
No, I know there's so much going on in this. I guess I could have like just said, you know, there's space marines getting trained, they get attacked, you know, they some survive, they go back to Terra, they come back to Mars with a plan. The plan fails and they go back to Terra and or no, they don't go back to Terra, they all die, right?
Yeah, all die. Yeah, you see that's more in line with what we expect from you. Anyway, no, that was a good synopsis actually. It hit all the bases. So how about we start with, I guess we'll start with the beginning. with the trial. Because, okay, the main character is this guy called the Carrion. He's called the Carrion because he's like this Raven Guard who escaped from just like, got all his limbs cut off or some shit in a fight against Xenos during the Great Crusade. And he was so, they had to fix him with Augmentics? Why the hell can't I
pronounce Augmentics, right? Yes.
Augmentics, yeah. they fix him up, but like the Night Lords, the Raven Guard are fighting with the Night Lords, which is actually a pretty good mix when you really get down to it. Because apparently they leave each other alone.
Yeah.
They mention it's like, yeah, we work well together because, you know, it's not like with the Salamanders, you have to fucking, you know, go hang out with them and shit and, you know, go to their fucking Thanksgiving dinners and all that stuff. Night Lords, essentially, they like to be left alone, so the Raven Guard, so they kind of work well together. But anyways, this guy. He gets back like wounded and bloody to the Night Lord's lions. The Night Lords just call him the Carrion because he's pretty much like he's the Walking Dead at that point. But they fix him up with Augmentics, but the thing is he's now too slow and lazy and shit, so they have to send him to get fixed up on Mars. But
he's lazy. That's awesome.
Well, no, he's not lazy. It's just he's like too slow to be a Raven Guard now. So they make him a Tech Marine, which is illogical. Sorry, what I said before didn't make sense. But let's go back to the trial. I think this is really probably my favorite scene in the book. It's a shame that it happens in the first couple of pages. Because, okay, while he's on, I guess, on Mars, I mean, he's getting, like, this guy has, the Carrion, he has, like, PTSD, right? And he keeps, getting memories of, you know, almost getting killed by the Xenos. And so they install something in his brain to keep the bad memories away, I guess. In the modern era, it's like, I guess it's like a robotic equivalent of like OxyContin or some shit, or like Vicodin. Oh. Just, you know, something that they give him to keep the bad thoughts away. And so he starts having like flashbacks. He has flashbacks back then. He also has flashbacks of this trial that apparently really marked him. It's this trial of this guy. What's his name? Bol?
Octel Bol.
Okay. And I guess all the aspiring tech marines get to watch this trial against this heretic. And, okay, what did this guy do? Why is he on trial?
He's making thinking machines because they're the best way to go.
Yes, he's making thinking machines, and you're not allowed making thinking machines. You remember why? Why aren't you allowed making machines that think?
Because they made thinking machines in the past and it almost destroyed humanity.
Exactly. It didn't go too well last time. it's called the War Against the Iron Men. That's all anybody remembers about it. At the conclusion of the Dark Age of Technology, about, like, I think 20,000 years ago or 15,000 years ago, eventually man created, take your pick, Cylons or Terminators, either way, they're, like, they made, like, machines that could think for themselves, and the machines rebelled. And all anybody ever remembers is, like, okay, this is in the distant, distant past. There's not a lot of memory about it. They call it the War Against the Iron Men, and they do remember that humanity was almost destroyed by it. So, and that's one of the things that ushered in the Age of Strife, along with the warp closing in on itself, because the birth of not the birth of Slaanesh, or the beginning of the gestation of Slaanesh, I figure. There was this war, and people do remember it in tales told of times of the distant past of the war against the Iron Men. So one of the important things that it's like cannibalism today, right? It's like the thing you don't do. You don't eat people. Well, in this universe, you don't make machines that think because the technology is there to do it. And so there's a thing called the Crimson Accords that you have to sign to join the Imperium. And one of the things in the Crimson Accords is you shall not make a machine that thinks. It's the highest level of tech heresy. And this guy did it.
Yeah, and he's super pumped about it too in this little sort of flashback that he's having. He's really trying to explain why it's a good thing that all humans should die, pretty much. That's what I got from it.
Yeah, well, the flesh is weak. You remember, this guy served... did you notice that? Because you know that machine that he gets, that thinking machine, the Abominable Intelligence?
Yeah.
Well, do you remember the Legion that found it, eh?
The Iron Tenth?
Yes,
sir.
The Iron Tenth, appropriately enough, found this thing. So, you think maybe, since Ferris Manus found this thing, maybe, the Legion sort of, rubbed off on it a little bit? And that's one of the reasons that it wants all fucking humans to die, because the flesh is weak.
Possibly. I mean, if you're surrounded by those, crazy guys who are just like, yeah, I'm going to chop my hand off, put a cybernetic one. It's like, oh, yeah, well, this makes perfect sense. They're trying to make themselves more like me.
Yeah, maybe there's something to that. Anyways. But yeah, this guy, he was working on machines to think, and he had this plot to destroy all life on Mars. Kind of not something you should do. So they arrested him, and they put him on trial. Did you notice the cult that he's a part of, the name of the cult that he's a part of?
I do not remember.
He is a Singularianist. Singularianist.
Okay.
Or Singularitarian. Anyways. You know did you ever hear of the Singularity?
The Singularity.
The Singularity.
No.
Well, okay, this is a reference to the Singularity. The Singularity is what... I don't know, scientists or people like futurists, I guess, what they call the moment when artificial intelligence will become as intelligent as human intelligence.
Gotcha.
And they estimate that somewhere 2040 or something, or 2030, somewhere in the future, that machines that think will be as advanced as human machines, and that will cause a singularity. Not exactly sure what all that stuff means, but that's. That's sort of what is referenced here. The idea that, I guess he's part of a cult that believes that, I guess, humans need to get evolve and get replaced by machine intelligence. So that's a direct reference to the idea of the singularity. I don't know that much about it, so I will leave it there. You see, I'm a historian, not a futurist. But yeah, that was an interesting callback, the singularitarianists or some shit. But yeah, he wants to make machines that think, can't do that, so what do they do to him?
Well, they decide to put him in stasis and put him on display so that other people won't do this.
Yeah. they put him in some fucking zoo or some shit there, so... a zoo...
Put you in a stasis thing, put you in the zoo.
Yeah. I guess it's a good way. It's you shouldn't think this way, because otherwise you're going to wind up a permanent exhibit, if you will. So this was an important part of the... this is the main problem right here. This guy had a plan, and this plan will be very important later. But what happens? Okay, this is a flashback that serves important narrative purposes to actually establish who this guy is and what he was trying to do. But then the Carrion, who's having these post-traumatic stress memories, he snaps back to it, right?
Yeah.
And what is he doing on Mars? Why is the Carrion on Mars?
Well, he's training to become a tech marine.
Yeah. And he's almost done. He's almost about to be sent back to Korax's Legion. Did I mention he was a Raven Guard? I think I did. And yeah, he's supposed to go back.
I think we did, yeah.
Yeah, it was mentioned. And he's got a bunch of buddies there. There's an Ultramarine there. But his best friend is this Iron Warrior called... What's his name?
Aulis. What is this? Skarmanica? Skarmanica?
Skarmanica? Yeah, a little more Spanish.
I think so, yeah.
And usually those names are more Greek in origin. His best friend is this Iron Warrior that does not at all have the iron, the grimness of most of Perturabo's men. But anyways, they're all buddy-buddy. And then they find out that, their signals are being jammed and there's something going on and there's, a fleet in orbit. And then they get attacked.
They try to put up what defense they can, but they don't really have any ammunition, really, or, I don't know, anything to defend themselves. It's pretty much these, how many Space Marines is it? 1, 2, 3, 4. It's 5 Space Marines against tons of Skitarii and a Warlord Titan.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. So yeah, they send the Sectarian, which I think is really cool, to go take them out. Because I guess with Kalbar Howe's plan, maybe we should slot this into the timeline. Actually, I forgot to do that. Where does this take place during the Heresy?
This is pretty much... when would this be?
It's like it's the very moment of Kalbar Howe's rebellion.
Yeah, pretty much. So I guess he figures he's got to take out these space marines because they could cause problems later.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess it's the moment with the scrap code, because the reason they can't reach anybody is because of the scrap code invasion. And then, yeah, it's like we got to fucking take out these Astartes before they can warn anybody or get off planet or anything like that. So they send in like waves of Sectari to try to deal with it. But, Astartes are Astartes. So they manage to fight back and they do a hell of a lot of damage till eventually this Warlord Titan from Legio Mortis shows up to finish them off. The Sectari like pull back and the Warlord Titan just fucking annihilates their school. I guess it's a school pretty much. So yeah, pretty simple. But before this happens though, the Carrion gets away.
Yeah, what is it that Olo says to him? He says something about... I can't remember what he says about the Iron Lords,
he says
something about how the Raven Guard are best meant to fly.
Yeah, exactly. He says something like, outside of perhaps dying on the rusted battlefields of Olympia, the best thing I can imagine is to die on... Since, you know, we are... the Iron Warriors are big fans of the machine and all that stuff. It's like, there's nothing better than to die... on Mars and be killed by a Titan. It's like, this is a good death. I'm cool with this death. But that's an Iron Warrior, but Ravens are meant to fly or something to that effect. And he picks him up.
And he throws him out the window.
And then he like hits a fucking lightning and shit and causes it to crash. So yeah, so he gets away because this guy, the Carrion, is nothing if not tough. So he manages to get away from this, and this happens at the exact same time that the Imperial Fists send like 400 Marines under Kemba Diaz to essentially capture as much Mark IV plate as possible from the forge of Lucas Crom, and also evacuate.
Yeah, and that's where he meets up with them.
And eventually, he manages to meet up with the Imperial Fists, and the Imperial Fists evacuate him out. And yeah, and that is how this is an important, interesting, well, not even not important, but interesting part of the story. It's like, this is how because clearly there were tech marines on Mars. We never asked this question, but it's interesting to have it answered. It's like, what happened to those tech marines on Mars? We know that the Legion sends aspirants to Mars to learn to be tech marines. So what happened to these guys when the rebellion broke out? Well, they were taken care of.
Yeah.
Except for this one.
Well, this is a group of them anyway.
Well, yeah, there could be other ones that maybe escaped, but They get taken back to Terra, or he gets taken back to Terra with the rest of the Imperial Fists, and... Oh, he goes to Luna. Sorry, he goes to the moon to get debriefed. And then he winds up back on Luna. And I guess he gets recruited. I guess fucking Big G there, Nathaniel Garrow, goes to recruit him.
Yeah, he becomes one of the Malkador's chosen.
Yes. Weren't there only supposed to be, like, 20 of them?
I'm sure there's a lot more because they actually appear in many books. So,
yeah, we should fucking count them down. But yeah, he becomes a knight errant. Can knight errants take servo harnesses?
Actually, it's funny that you should say this because remember I painted a knight errant for my 2-week hobby challenge. Well, my knight errant has a servo harness, and he's a psyker.
Oh, okay. Are you gonna make him where you go? You should make him this guy.
No, this guy's dead, man.
Well, way to ruin the book, Mark.
I think we already said that at the beginning.
Well, maybe he got away.
Nah, he's probably dead.
Yeah, that's too bad. I like this character. But okay, he goes to Mars, becomes a knight errant, and then for some reason he's just hanging. He's hanging out in the Imperial Palace while fucking Malkador Dorne and Lucas Crom are like talking about the future of the Imperium. Like probably the three most important men in the Imperium right now. They're chatting, and this guy is fucking hanging out.
It's the Fabricator General.
Yeah, it's Fabricator General. Lucas Crom, the Fabricator General.
That's not his name.
Crom. I know, but they changed his name. Kane?
It's Zagoras Kane is his name.
I thought it was Crom. Oh, I'm getting confused. Isn't Lucas Crom the guy that got rescued by the Imperial Fists?
No, he died.
Did he die?
Yeah, Kane, the Fabricator General, man. He's the one that escaped. The Fabricator Locum at the time.
That wasn't Lucas Crom?
No.
Okay, well, never mind. I apologize. I made a mistake. I remember Mechanicum differently. Okay, sorry. It's Kane. Okay, Fabricated General Kane, yeah. Malkador, the Regent of Terra, and Dorne, the Praetorian of the Emperor. They're chatting about the war, and you got this knight errant that's just hanging out in the back. There is a reason, actually. It's not afraid. But what are they talking about? This is like a year later or something like that. I think this must be around a year later. And they're talking about what to do with Mars.
Well, they're discussing what... Yeah, they're trying to figure out what to do, and Dorne's pretty much talking about supply and demand at this point, which is pretty funny. But yeah, basically he's saying that they need to...
No, he's talking about, like, supply and demand. It's because Kane is asking him, like, why didn't your Marines try to save Mars instead of just, like, taking as much fucking booty as they could, like, in escaping? Like, they acted like fucking pirates instead of acting like the saviors of mankind. So, like, why did you, like, abandon these forges instead of, like, why didn't the might of the Imperial Fist show up and, like, nip this rebellion in the bud? And his answer was like, my Astartes are better used elsewhere.
Standing around doing nothing.
Well, they're fortifying the Imperial Palace. But yeah, they are doing not that much. And fucking Malkador gets a good dig at Dorne at the very end too. But we'll get back to that.
Yeah, so basically Dorne wants to exterminatus Mars to deny Horus the resources when Horus shows up. And Kane isn't too happy with that.
Oh, no. Nor should he be.
Yeah, he's basically saying, like, if you exterminatus Mars, this is probably going to turn forges all over the Imperium to Horus's cause.
Yeah. Well, before that, like, Lucas Crumb first tries to appeal to Dorne's humanity. It's like...
Kane
tries to appeal to Kane's humanity. Kane tries to appeal to Dorne's humanity and tell him, it's like, look, you're just going to kill billions of innocent people. That are just like ordinary people, like we met in Mechanicum, in the book Mechanicum a while back. It's like, you're just going to kill all these people. But the thing is, the forces of order in this universe aren't any nicer than the forces of chaos. So he doesn't give a shit about fucking civilian casualties. He wants to deny a prize to the War Master. So when that doesn't work, Kane essentially tries to appeal to a more strategic, diplomatic side of Dorne, a more rational, calculating side of Dorne, and tells him that if you destroy Mars, you know that Mars is the center of the Martian cult, and if you do this, like, you'll have forge worlds all over the Imperium that will declare for Horus. Why wouldn't they? I mean, this is what the Imperium does to Mars, and it's been mentioned many times by people like I think Alan Bly's mentioned it before, that had there not been a Horus heresy, had Horus not led a rebellion against the Emperor, there's a good chance that Mars was going to rebel against the Emperor. Like, the Mechanicum was getting sick of this at the same time. There's a reason that so much of the Mechanicum sided with Horus and shit. They were sick and tired of Terra.
Yeah.
Like, look at what happened with Xena, for example, you know? And so, if Mars was exterminated, was completely destroyed, was leveled, there's a good chance that all those, like border, sorry, I'm using like American Civil War terms, like border states, like fucking Delaware and Kentucky, you know, or Maryland, like that could have gone either way, that were like teetering. Like you could have that in this universe too. There's like forge worlds that are like teetering, and if you destroy Mars, then you're definitely going to push them into the camp of the War Master. So that's Kane trying to appeal to Dorne's strategic side, because his human side is dead. Because he's a lawful evil servant of order.
Yeah. Do you think maybe Kane should just offer Dorne a bag of cats?
What? What about a bag
Never mind.
Of cats?
Never
I don't
mind.
Understand. No, explain yourself.
No, you don't know the Eye of Horus and how many cats?
Oh yeah. Can Dorne eat? Okay, that's true. Sorry.
Maybe that would have won him over
was,
in a heartbeat.
That was a while ago. That was a while ago.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. But so, okay, Kane's appealing to a strategic side, and Malkador, you know, is like, oh, you might have a point. And it just so happens, I have a plan.
Of course he does, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. So he brings the Carrion, and okay, what's the plan? He brings the Carrion in. It's like, this is why this guy's been fucking hiding, you know, just hanging out in the shadows. So he brings him into the conversation. It's like, what's your plan, Carrion? So what's his plan?
Oh, right. Well, the first part of the plan is he wants to go back to Mars, and he needs to free Octal Bull because he wants him to go to that, what is it called, the Vertex Australis?
Vertex Australis, which would be the... Well, explain what's happening with Mars. Like, there's on the north and south poles of Mars, there's like these machines that keep life, that make it possible for Mars to sustain life, because Mars is a dead world. So it doesn't generate a strong electromagnetic field to protect it from radiation and cosmic rays.
Yeah.
So you got machines that are doing that for it. And this guy, his plan was to shut down those machines and thus make Mars uninhabitable to flesh creatures.
Yeah. So they need him to do this. That's pretty much the extent of their plan.
Yep. So essentially, yeah, he's going to break this guy out, and then he's going to take advantage of his abominable machine, abominable intelligence, to go shut down the polar ice cap machine and purge life of all Mars. Purge life of all Mars. Purge Mars of all life. Oh, yeah, it's a decent plot, and this seems to pass Kane. Because I guess Kane doesn't really care all that much about all those innocents, all those innocent people that would be killed in the Extreme Nullis operation. It's more all the, you know, the technology and knowledge of Mars that he really cares about.
Yeah, people would be more accepting of this, provided that, you know, all the goodies are still there.
Yeah. Question, would not a virus bombardment do the same thing?
Maybe, but it would destroy everything too, wouldn't it?
Only a few, yeah, you're right. Because the problem with the virus bombardment is when you virus bombard a planet, it creates so much combustible gas as people are like rotting away that if like anybody lights a match, the whole place will go up.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess this will do the job, and then all they need to do is fix the machine later on, and they say they might be able to do it, and then yeah, all the technology and all the infrastructure, all the knowledge will still be there. For loyalists.
Yeah. Because I guess they do go into to say that the vast majority of them are traitors that are on Mars. There's only a few loyalists
left.
Yeah,
that's what they like to say. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure that's the truth, but.
Exactly. So once again, those people that keep shitting on me for saying that the war is not between good versus evil, it's between order versus chaos. This is the plan. The plan is to murder billions of people to make sure that the infrastructure is okay for the loyalists down the line. That is the plan right now. Don't come
yeah,
and tell
it
me...
Yeah, it sounds like a good guy plan.
Yeah, it sounds like a good guy plan. No, there's no good... Everybody's evil in this fucking universe, all right? God damn, I'm just sick of hearing how the fucking, like, chaos is evil and the Emperor's good and he's doing everything for good. Look at... This is the plan. This is their plan. This is their glorious plan to save Mars. Kill all the people. And the good guys are doing this. No, I'm sick of fucking hearing this. I'm sick of hearing how the...
Hey, it's different layers of evil. But we'll say that.
Everybody is evil in this universe.
I know you love the order versus chaos thing. And if we ever have an Age of Sigmar podcast, we can talk about it there because it's right in your face, actually. But
yeah, you can start your Age of Sigmar podcast. I've got enough with one podcast, and I don't play Age of Sigmar. Even though I have nothing against it, let's be clear.
It wouldn't be edited. I'll let you know that if I ever did one.
Well, yeah, definitely not editing a second podcast.
Raw, uncut.
You don't know how this sounds like, raw and uncut. You have no idea. Skype is a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, true. Anyway, back to the 31st millennium.
Okay. Good. That's where I prefer to live. Okay, this is their horrible, horrible plan. And at this point in the book, I'm just hoping that the forces of chaos, the good guys, manage to repel this horrific plan. So I'm definitely rooting for the good guys defending their planet against a possible extermination campaign against all life that has been engineered by the Emperor's servants. Let's move back to Mars. Now, of course, the Raven Guard, so he had no difficulty infiltrating the planet.
No, none whatsoever. It was pretty simple, actually. It was like, what, a page?
No, there wasn't even a page. It just shows up on Mars. It's like he yada-yadded over it.
Yeah, pretty much. And he's got his servitors with him.
Yeah.
That's his strike team. Him and a bunch of servitors.
Yeah, some servitors with like rotor cannons and like mouth grills and all that stuff. It's kind of weird creatures.
Yeah.
Which I love. I love all the weird Geiger-esque fucking weird machinery stuff of the Imperium. It just takes me back to all that old Rogue Trader stuff that I love, all that art. So yeah, the infiltrates him, breaks Bol out of the stasis field, and then you find out what Bol has been. We didn't talk about the future reading machine.
Oh yeah, that's pretty important, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of important. I can't believe we didn't mention. Yeah, what is this thing?
It's basically a device that predicts the future, like you just said.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. This is what
Bol predicted the heresy.
Yeah.
Well, not necessarily the heresy, but what was going to happen on Mars.
Yeah. This is a machine that predicts stuff. And that's what we were talking about earlier with this artificial intelligence that Bol was working. Well, what the artificial intelligence does is it predicts the future. And they figure they can use this thing because this is the thing that wanted to purge all life, because they saw that if they purge all life, they could, you know, stop Mars from going into civil war, obviously. And this is the thing that they're trying to break out. So the Bol, they break him out, and then he opens up like a crate of his belongings, I guess. And he's got this like cherub, and he's also got this like fucking ball. And after that, he like inserts this orb of this like alien orb and shit. And he I guess he takes a part of it, like a small part of it, and puts it into his own brain, and then he becomes less crazy.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. And yeah, after that, I think he's pretty much the Abominable Intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
He is, right? Like, after he puts the intelligence into himself, he becomes essentially he becomes AI, right? Pretty much?
Basically, yeah. Because before, he's like, you know, like just chittering on and like making no sense at this point.
Yeah. Okay. So then they go on an adventure. Oh, yeah, that's when they wake up all those Castellan robots we were talking about before.
Yeah, they're like, well, I guess we need an army, so let's raise up this entire maniple, or, like, cohort of robots.
Yeah. Which was, I guess, kind of cool. They got, like, I don't know how many there were. There was probably, like, a couple hundred, right?
Oh, at least, yeah. There's tons and tons of robots.
And then it's, like, I think one of the best parts of the book, in the novella, because they go through... Like, they go on, like, an adventure fighting their way south to the Southern Polar Fortress. And throughout it all, they get, like, hunted by a Warhound Titan that eventually catches up to them, like, near a lake. Oh, there is a lake. There is water on Mars.
Isn't it, like, a pool of, like, lubricants and shit, though?
It could be. I'm not sure. But, yeah, they're hunted by a Warhound Titan, and they get, like... They attack some trader installations to get through, and then they bypass others, and they get like attacked by like fighter wings, like bombing raids and everything like that. But I guess even like I imagine it like fucking ISIS convoy going through the desert and shit. You know, sometimes like drones catch them and sometimes they don't.
Yeah,
this is very hard to catch like tiny little fucking robots and a single. They're what kind of transporter? They're in a Trieros, right?
Yeah, they are.
So they have a single Trieros and a couple hundred Robbie the Robots. And so they fight their way south. And yeah, this is great. I think it's really cool how it describes like the adventure going south. It's like they did this, and then they did this, and then they did this. And at one point, they fought this guy, and they were hunted all along by this like lone Warhound Titan. I think that's a really, really cool scene, like talking about their adventures going south. I really, really enjoyed that part. It almost felt like a chronicle, like kind of, I don't know, like... You know, like the Odyssey or something, you know?
Oh, yeah, it was pretty cool.
And eventually they make it to the frozen polar ice cap, the southern polar ice cap, and then they realize that their plans are undone. Or potentially...
Yeah, it's a trap.
Yeah, it's obviously a trap. Obviously they knew they were coming because there's three Warhound Titans and, like, tons of fucking fortified... Like, the place has obviously been heavily fortified. And so the Carrion believes that, you know, that potentially the traders knew that they were coming... They still managed to get in. Essentially, they sacrificed the rest of the Castellan robots, except for like five of them.
Yeah, all the named robots.
Yeah, the named robots. Essentially, the inner guard of Bol / the Abominable Intelligence. So the rest of them get sacrificed to try to draw the attention of the base fortifications, like its weapons, and also like the three Warhound Titans that are like stalking the grounds. The Carrion manages to get them in. They fight their way inside, and then there's the big cliche ending. Or at least kind of cliche.
Ooh. Yeah, guess who's not dead?
Yeah. Guess who is not dead? I did not see... I'm not saying I saw this coming. I totally didn't. But it's kind of like a cliche to have, you know... Yeah, the guy that you thought was dead turns out he's not dead and he's evil now. Oh, all right.
Yeah.
Well, I guess in this particular case, he's good because he's gonna try to stop the genocide of the Martian people. So I guess in this case, he's the good guy.
Yeah.
So it turns out our Iron Warrior's friend, whose name is, once again?
It is...
I've written this down.
Aulis.
Anyways, he decided... he saw this coming and fortified the base because the Carrion is nothing if not predictable, apparently. He fortified the base, and now... Because what happened was when the Warlord Titan demolished their school, he managed to get away. He managed to survive, but he was all beaten up, and he was captured by... forces like Kelber Hall's forces, and then I guess they gave him a big dose of scrap code, and he saw how beautiful scrap code is, how amazing it is.
He liked it a lot.
Oh yeah, it was awesome, so cool. And then now he's working for Kelber Hall, and they gave him a new. Is he a dreadnought?
He's bigger than a siege automata, so he's definitely not a dreadnought.
Well, could he? Well, could he be like a super big, like a Leviathan is about the size of a siege automata, isn't he? Isn't it? Could he be a Leviathan?
Maybe, I don't know, because he definitely has like, can't you see his face and like his upper body in this robot? Like he's like sticking out of like all this machinery. It kind of reminds me of a Dreadknight from 40K.
Yeah, I didn't get that. I really thought he was encased in this machine. I'm not sure. But anyways, he's now in a machine. A big one. And, he defends the life of the people of Mars by defeating the Emperor's genocidal servants.
Yeah, that's why he wins. But, which is awesome.
Again, there's this scene, I enjoyed it. And I didn't see it coming. I still feel it's a little cliched, though. Especially when the Carrion tries to, like... convince him the Iron Warrior tries to convince him like that is like you just need to join us, we can rule the galaxy together kind of shit, you know.
Yeah,
we can rule the galaxy as father and son kind of shit. It's kind of a cliched scene, but not a bad one. And often cliches aren't, it's just the reason that they keep coming back is what makes them cliched is because they're touching scenes. I mean, it's what humans we like to see. Anyways, there's no new stories. Every fucking story is the same. And he tries to convince him that, like, if you just accept the scrap code, you know, like, you'll see the fucking truth of the universe and all that stuff. Scrap code is pretty much like a demon, like it's demonic, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, he's trying to convince him, probably turn him to the ruinous powers to make him see the truth of the universe. And I guess it doesn't work. And the Carrion tries to burn the whole thing down by, I guess, like sabotaging the because it's also a factory, this thing, apparently.
Yeah, they're in a giant, gigantic factory complex.
Yeah, so he like spills like vats of molten lava, and it's like the end of Revenge of the Sith when everything's like burning down. And turns out. I guess one of the Castellan robots. What happened? Okay, this is part I didn't really get. What happened with the Castellan robot and the Iron Warrior at the end?
I didn't quite get it myself.
Okay, one of the robots becomes sentient.
Well, they were all sentient, actually, to begin with.
Were they?
As he brought them along. And I guess this one robot decided that they didn't need to do this, because doesn't it basically become the machine?
It does become the machine. Yeah, you're right.
Because I guess it's like, maybe the scrap code stuff isn't as bad as we thought it was, and decides to become the Vertex Australis.
Oh, it becomes the Vertex Australis.
I think so, because it starts to glow. It starts to glow with like this like immense power and shit as they're in there.
Yeah. And then they carry it. Yeah, okay. I'm. Damn it. I'd have to reread that ending. There's some confusing shit that happened.
Yeah, there's a lot of robo talk.
There is a lot of robo talk. And then, the Carrion dies, and it's so sad too with his raven.
Yeah, poking at his head.
It turns out it's dead, and it's a sad scene. I would have cried if this was in the cinema. poor Raven. What's the Raven gonna do now? Unless he comes back later, like Super Raven shit.
You never know.
Yeah, maybe because it didn't die, so maybe it'll come back as an important character down the line.
I guess we didn't see a head, right? You know, headless body, so he might be alive.
Yeah, exactly. The Carrion dies, unfortunately, because I really liked that character, surprisingly. I didn't expect to like him, but he's actually really, really cool. And the Iron Warrior also survived. And the Iron Warrior melded a little bit with the fucking Abominable Intelligence, I think. Something like that happened.
Yeah.
Didn't it? Because he talked to it for a little bit and then got away. So hopefully we see that character again as well, because it's really cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's pretty much Cybernetica. I don't know. The ending was weird.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. It was a little strange.
Yeah. I'm not sure anymore. You see, I read it, but I feel like I need to read it again to truly understand everything that happened. Surely one of our more knowledgeable listeners will have a better grasp of this ending than I did. But, it seemed like, okay, the Carrion dies. The Abominable Intelligence seems to have gotten away and perhaps has even fucking melded with the scrap code. And the Iron Warrior character, I guess everything's just mixed together a little bit.
I think so.
Yeah. Then the Carrion dies. Plan failed, which is good because it was an evil plan. Let's be clear on that. The good guys won the day by preventing genocide on Mars, the genocide of the flesh. And then we go back to Terra and something significant happens. What you said earlier about this not being significant is untrue.
Which, the last part?
No, you said, the last part. It's because you said earlier in your synopsis that nothing of any consequence happened. And I think that's untrue.
No, I know. It is true.
No, something.
It's 100% true.
Something very consequential happened. The plan having failed.
Yes.
Nonetheless, the Imperial Fists have understood that committing genocide on Mars is not the best way forward. And I feel like Malkador manipulated Dorne in this story. And I think that's the most significant thing. Because...
Probably.
Okay, let me explain. At the very end, Malkador gets a dig at Dorne, right? It's like, you know what? The battle is not fought on Terra. The battle is being fought out there by your brothers.
You know, they're not standing around.
Yeah, exactly. So Dorne is like, and they haven't mentioned like the Primarch's rage or the he has a look of the Primarch's wrath or something, or a Primarch's wrath.
Yeah.
So yeah, like Malkador gets a fucking solid dig at Dorne. It's like, you know what? Other people are fighting this war, and you're just sitting here, right? You're doing nothing. Other people are fighting this war. And I guess saying that and seeing his plans for genocide fail, he decides like, okay, fine, I'll commit my legion. We will retake Mars. And then he asks for like to talk to his contact my captains. I will seek their counsel or some shit. Right? I think Malkador in this story, the theme of the story, the main plot of the story is Malkador manipulating Dorne, because you remember, like, the Carrion was in the background, right? Like,
yeah.
Everything was seemed because, okay, Dorne had made up his mind. We will bombard Mars. We will level Mars. We will commit exterminatus. We will destroy it. And then Malkador just happens to have a guy in the wings, like, when there's like, oh, this guy has another idea that perhaps we could try. Perhaps you would like this plan, even though it's completely unrealistic. That wasn't going to happen.
Even at the end of the book, Malkador says that it was a gamble. You know, we didn't. You don't always win when you gamble.
Exactly. It's the same way like Erebus' gamble with spear. Like that wasn't going to fucking work. Like, and Erebus admitted it, but you threw the dice on him. I think Malkador didn't even expect that to work.
Probably not.
But Malkador gave Dorne a plan that would satiate his genocidal impulses of destroying all life on Mars, while at the same time having a low enough chance of actually succeeding, that after that he'd be forced to actually rethink his basic strategy. And then he gives him that little dig about how, you know, the war is being fought outside of Terra, you know? And then it's like, fine, I'll fucking commit my legion, I'll retake Mars. I think this is a story about fucking Malkador manipulating Dorne into committing his legion to the fight. Committing his legion to actually assaulting Mars, retaking it before the War Master can use it as a base for the conquest of Terra. That's what I think the story's about.
I agree with you, man. Definitely.
Wait. Hold on. Say that again.
I agree with you.
You agree with me? This might be only the second or
third time agree with you on this, man.
In the history of this show, of my kooky theories. I think that's like one of the first you've actually agreed with.
Yeah, I think so. But I agree with you.
That's just awesome. I think I'm just going to end this segment right here.
Yeah. Well, question. From the history that we know of the Horus heresy, we know that when Horus finally gets to Terra, he just bypasses Mars entirely on his way there.
Wait,
so do you think that, do they retake it? Well, at least that's in the older fluff, is that he just bypassed it entirely.
I don't remember them bypassing Mars.
Yeah, it's there, man.
Are you sure?
Pretty sure.
I trust you. I don't remember that part of the story. Yeah. I remember that in that board game, you're allowed to use Calibur Hall. Did they go pick up Calibur Hall?
Kane.
No, Calibur Hall.
There's no Calibur Hall in that game.
In the board game?
I'm thinking of the spaceship one, the Attack on the Ventral Spirit.
No, remember the Horus Heresy, like, Axe and Allies kind of game?
No, I'm just thinking of the expansion they made. It was the spaceship. No, I'm pretty sure you're right, on that one, that he's there. So maybe they don't pacify Mars, and that's why he doesn't need to stop.
Yeah, but most of the Primarchs are in that game either, so it's not exactly canon. I'm not sure. I really don't remember if Mars is bypassed. I remember Mars... I don't remember. I don't remember at all. You might be right. So maybe they do retake it. This seems like another one of those questions that has.
Or maybe they. Answer. Well, no. Maybe they don't. Yeah. Maybe they don't retake it, and that's why it just goes by. Like, what's the point of fighting there if it's on your side?
Yeah. Well, that's the way I had understood it. I had understood that it was the Martian Civil War was still raging to a degree, but it was mainly like Mars was mainly controlled by forces loyal to the War Master, and that's why.
Yeah.
But you didn't need to commit forces to it. Like, it was essentially secured. You didn't need to pass it. I'm not sure about this one. I don't think that the Imperial Fists retake Mars. I've never heard that.
I don't think they're capable, to be honest. I don't think their legion is capable of doing that.
Oh, no, not at all.
I think you'd need legions to take Mars.
Absolutely. Yeah, but they're so overconfident, though. Remember, he sends 500 Astartes or 400 Astartes under Kimber Diaz.
Yeah.
And of course they get mauled to shit. And it's so hilarious in Mechanicum, that scene where they land and they start getting attacked. And it's like, holy shit, the Martians are actually fighting back.
And they're really fighting back.
Wait, the Mechanicum can actually deploy forces that are the equal of Astartes? This doesn't sound right. We're supposed to be
What
the
do you
best.
Mean? We were lied to.
And also, Malkador says something. I think it's Malkador that says, it's like, you would have to commit half your legion to take Mars. I'm pretty sure you'd have to commit the whole fucking thing.
Oh,
plus the phalanx, plus your fleet to actually bust through the Ring of Iron.
I don't know. In my opinion, it would require multiple legions because that's the home of titans.
Mm. Many, right? Many titans.
Like, we're talking, what, hundreds, if not thousands of titans on Mars?
Oh, yeah.
Like,
oh, no. Like, I'm looking forward to this story because clearly this is a setup for a future story which will involve the Imperial Fists striking back at Mars, but even the force of an entire legion isn't going to take Mars. I don't believe it. I don't believe it. Black Library, I'm sure you can convince me and you'll get a good author to write it and everything like that, and I don't believe for a fucking second that even the entire Imperial Fist fucking legion could take Mars.
Yeah.
It just doesn't sound believable to me.
But yeah, I'm just trying to think of the numbers that the Dark Mechanicum has there. Like, there are, like, literally hundreds, if not trillions, of people on Mars, even after the catastrophe.
How'd you go from hundreds to trillions?
I should have said hundreds of billions to trillions.
Well, I don't know about hundreds. This is definitely many, many billions of people. A trillion is a lot of people.
I know. But, this is 40K scale, man, scale.
Yeah, scale. Well, I would say, like, at least, like, fucking 100 billion people on Mars. I don't know, unless... you can somehow take control of the dragon. If you can wake the dragon, that'll fuck some shit up.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Maybe
they'll bring the Saturnine regiments with them again.
The which?
The Saturnine regiments again. Maybe they'll bring them again.
Oh, that'd be cool. I want more details about Saturn. That's the one planet I'm so fascinated with. And it's so important for the history of the Solar Auxilia, too. Yeah, I'd love to see more about the Saturnine regiments. But either way, I don't believe it. I don't believe that the Imperial Fist can take Mars. It's just, I know that that's what this book is supposed to set up, but I don't fucking believe it. And I'm not...
I think we're going to get a message about this.
No, I'm not shitting on the Imperial Fist at all. Like, my Iron Warriors couldn't take Mars. The Ultramarines couldn't take Mars. Like, how the hell are... No one's going to take Mars. Just keep it blockaded. Like, fuck.
Yeah.
Like, for the love of God. Oh, other cool thing that was mentioned in this book that I really liked. Apparently, Horus has blockade runners.
Oh, yeah, that's right, eh?
So, Horus is actually getting supplied from Mars. They don't usually get through. But again, this is like the U.S. Civil War with blockade runners and everything like that. I have to get through the Union blockade. Fucking USS Alabama and shit. Or CSS Alabama. Interesting stuff, man. I like the idea of it. I would love a whole book about fucking running the blockade.
That'd actually make a neat novella. That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, like running the blockade to try to get fucking resources to try to get supplies to the War Master. That'd be a really, really cool book. I would love that. But yeah, it's nice little details that get added to this. This is an amazingly like meaty book, like novella. This is like, what, 100 pages?
130, I think, something like that.
130 pages? This has so much content to it. I mean, I'm really, really impressed by it.
Yeah, definitely. I love this novella.
I thought you said you weren't sure.
At first, I wasn't sure, but like when we were talking earlier, I hadn't quite finished it.
Oh, okay.
So I was like maybe 20 or 30 pages from the end.
Oh, I gotcha.
Because I had a feeling that nothing was going to come of this when I was reading it until I got to the end of the book.
Oh, yeah. No, there's some... It's a really good story. I'm still not sure about everything that happens in the end. I think I'm going to have to give it another read through. But it's an amazing consequential and well written and a lot of fun. I liked it a lot more than I thought it was. I was going to like it. Because remember, we picked this because we weren't sure what to do. I mean, it's like, oh, fuck, we haven't decided like what novel we wanted to do because we got a couple that are programmed down the way. And it's like, and we just had this week, it's like we had no idea what we wanted to talk about. So I went to see a list of books and when they were released, it's like, oh, this novel Cybernetica was released exactly a year ago. Why don't we do this one?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and it's really good. So people out there, and I know that there's a lot of people, because when we did Talarn, I got a lot of comments from people that had not read Talarn and still listened to our treatment of it, that still enjoyed it. And that actually went out to like buy the digital like copies of Talon Executioner, for example.
That's awesome.
After we talked about it. So I implore you guys, check out Cybernetica. Like Rob Sanders does an amazing fucking job with this book. It's surprisingly good. And it's got a surprising amount of meat to it.
Yeah, definitely. So on that note, JP, what are we going to do next time?
I don't know yet, but can I just mention one thing before we move on?
Sure thing, man.
One thing I wanted to just mention before I forget is the writing style of, because I just mentioned Rob Sanders doing a great job, the writing style of this book and any book about the Mechanicum kind of bugs me a little bit. Not because it's written badly, and quite the opposite, actually. It's very well written, and this one in Mechanicum as well. It's just that I when I'm reading these books, there's so much, the author always tries to give things sort of like this fake like Mechanicum techno names and everything like that, and that sometimes draws me out of the story.
Yeah.
When they start talking about like it's written, sometimes the writing style of when you write about Mechanicum, it doesn't come out very naturally. You have a bunch of like sci-fi terms that come out, which isn't bad, but it does drag you out of a little bit. I just wish that the authors were a little more conservative with using a lot of these like these terms.
Maybe they're doing that to try and draw you into it, actually.
I feel that the main reason is to invoke the strangeness of the Mechanicum. The Mechanicum is very alien. It is very weird.
Yeah.
And I feel that they often use bizarre terms or just change the name of stuff and just write in a certain way that essentially invokes this alienness, this weirdness to it. It's just that I find that a lot of the time it drags me out of the story because it doesn't flow very naturally. And perhaps being more conservative with these phrases, it's just often it's written in an unnatural way. But I think,
gotcha.
I think it's done on purpose because it's supposed to be unnatural. I just feel like it drags me out of it a little bit. It's none of that, though. Like, and it's not bad. And I don't think they should stop doing it. I just wish they would be a little more conservative with these the phrasing and the way to structure paragraphs and a lot of these terms. Because I feel that it kind of drags me out of the story a little bit. But outside of that, it's fucking awesome. Rob Sanders did an amazing job with this story. A story that I did not expect to enjoy as much as I did.
Yeah, definitely, man.
Yeah, and I want to know what that fucking Iron Warrior is. I thought he was like a Leviathan Dreadnought or something, but you might be right. He's something completely different. I hope we see this guy again, frankly.
Yeah, that'd be sweet in the story when they attack.
Yeah, I hope the War Master's forces pick him up on the way to Terra and shit. We see this guy on the fucking gates of the Imperial Palace kicking shit.
That would be sweet.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Okay, coming back to your earlier question, what are we doing next time?
Well, we're going to be talking about a few World Eater-related books here. Well, short stories. Mostly. Nothing novella-sized, eh? They're all, like, just super short. No,
just a couple short stories, really.
Yeah.
Because we want to get to the bottom of who the World Eaters are, and we're hoping that by discussing a couple short stories, it helps us understand. So we will be talking about the short story After Dashia, the short story Lord of the Red Sands, and the short story Heart of the Conqueror. All interesting little tales. We're hoping that by talking about those and by supplementing the information with stuff from like Index Astartes and from the Big Forge World books, I think we can have a nice healthy discussion about the who the World Eaters are as a legion.
Blood?
They will involve blood.
Okay.
I can guarantee that there will be blood and skulls involved. But we like to discuss these short stories, and we don't always get a chance to do it. So next episode, we're going to take advantage of it. It'll probably be a little bit shorter than usual, but I'm hoping that there's going to be some interesting content nonetheless.
Sounds good to me.
All right. So that out of the way, let's go to the Vox Box. All right, welcome back to the Vox Box. In this, today's Vox Box, we're going to be trying something. We're going to try to do fully audio messages. Once again, I will repeat myself. We are soliciting people to send us your comments via audio message so we can play them on air to give the Vox Box a feel of a radio call-in show. Also, it saves me destroying your words by me stuttering through them. It's so much better if people can get a hold of us with their in their own words. That would be our ideal. So today we got a couple of audio messages, and we're going full audio today. So we're going to see how that feels in the hopes of encouraging people to send us more audio messages. So the first one, this is from Andrew, and it's about the Space Wolves and the color scheme for the Space Wolves. Very interesting stuff.
Hi guys, this is listener Andrew Gray. I'm in Los Angeles, California. And I'm leaving you a message because you recently asked why the Space Wolves were changed from this light gray color scheme to a darker gray and when exactly that happened. Well, I actually know a bit about the answers to those questions, so I thought I would share them with you. The change actually happened in around 1994 when the second edition Space Wolves Codex was coming out. And I bought that codex when I was a kid. I was 14. It was my very first codex, actually my first ever Games Workshop purchase. And I bought that, loved the models, loved the Space Wolves, bought myself a Space Wolf army, took them all home, and painted them in Space Wolves Grey, which is this pale grey color, because that was logical. I was 14, I painted my Space Wolves in Space Wolves Grey. Made sense. But they didn't look at all like what I could see in the codex, and that struck me as really strange. So what I did was I went back to my store and I asked my manager, okay, why do my Space Wolves not look like the ones in the book? And he told me that they'd actually started painting their studio army in Shadow Grey instead of Space Wolves Grey. And the reason for that was that in photographs, the pale Space Wolves Grey actually looked a lot like white, especially in black and white photos. Back then, Games Workshop actually had a number of black and white photos in their publications. So this was causing a lot of confusion in their customer base, because Space Wolves were described as being gray in the text, but they looked white in all the photographs, and that was, you know, causing all sorts of issues. So they changed to a gray that was unmistakably gray in photographs, and that was Shadow Gray, which is the color that we know and love today as the color that Volker Frederica should be painted in. So this was obviously a store manager telling me this, and, you know, take that with a grain of salt or whatever, but actually I got confirmation of this a few years later at Games Day. There was an entry into Golden Demon that was a very pale Space Wolf color, and I mentioned it to a staffer that I think might have been Alan Merritt, saying, hey, I remember like when this change happened, and it really confused me, and now people are going back to this pale Space Wolf gray. And he said, yeah, that was, you know, something we did for this reason. He basically told me the same story. So I'm pretty sure it's legit if people want to maybe follow up, or if they know something I don't, then fair enough. But that's the story I've heard from two different sources at Games Workshop. So hope this helps. Hope it answers your question. And keep up the great work. Thanks, guys.
Holy shit, that answers the question, doesn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Because, yeah, when we were talking about how to paint Space Wolves, we were completely confused as to why there was a change in the colors to between, like, some really light gray to like, the blue gray that people use today for 40K Space Wolves. Well, that's actually a really likely answer. That makes a hell of a lot of sense, more than anything else we've heard. Unlike, for example, what are the other legions that that change their colors? Fucking Dark Angels, right? Dark Angels switch from black to green to honor their homeworld of Caliban, right?
Yes, sir.
But there was no justification, similar justification for why Space Wolves changed their colors. So if it's just because of photography, that makes a hell of a lot of sense. So Andrew, thank you so much for sending us that. We are really, really grateful because we were confused as hell over that. And it sounds pretty fucking legit. So thank you for this. Next up in our audio extravaganza is a message from George.
Firstly, I wanted to give you my two pennies on the point you raised in episode 31 about Horus not believing Fulgrim could ever convert Ferus Manus. One thing that makes me a big fan of the 10th Legion is that they're so close to the 40k universe's grey area of morality as you can get. While they are staunchly loyalists, they show that there is really very little separating their hatred and disregard for human life from that of the traitors. The word bearers, as for example in Betrayer, may wring their hands about committing genocide to further their overall goal, but we see the Iron Hands nuking entire populations merely as punishment for towing the traitor line. This makes it easy for me to imagine that Horus thought the Iron Hands would be willing to listen. Manus is pessimistic about the strength of humanity, and it would be worth gambling that he would see their weakness as unworthy of his sacrifice once the Great Crusade reached its end. All that separates him from Fulgrim is stubbornness when confronted with an opposing dogma. While I agree with you both that Fulgrim is a fantastic heresy novel, I felt let down by the depiction of Ferus Manus. He seems a complete tool and doesn't make any wise decisions at all in the book. It's really annoying to see Fulgrim turn up and point out the obvious mistakes he's making when he's trying to pursue the Diasporex. His legion seems better off without his foolish leadership, and while it's an awesome model, I've decided not to include the Primarch in my army for this reason, and because he's dead. Secondly, I'd like to see what you think about a historical question I have. While a lot of armaments and strategies in the Heresy have their historical inspirations, I have trouble seeing an equivalent for the Demolisher Cannon and its larger variants. Is there a similar tank or artillery piece in modern history that's used for sieges which sacrifices range for the ability to pulverize targets? Or is this something that GW made up to add a tactical flavor to their games? Thanks, guys.
So thank you, George. That was awesome. Okay, first part of your question. First part of your comment, sorry. Ferus Manus. Were you let down by how Ferus Manus was treated? You fucking hate the 10th, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I definitely agree that his treatment wasn't so good. He's just coming off as... He just seems like such an idiot and shouldn't be in charge.
I guess
like
that's
he's all brute force and no thinking. Like he's kind of like Angron in respects, you know.
I never thought of that. Yeah, It's because, yeah, he's supposed to be smarter than this, and he doesn't really get a good treatment. And it's a shame. And then, okay, this comes back to what we were saying before. George, actually, you bring something up that that's been bothering us, that there should have been a book about Ferris Manus before Fulgrim. Like, it's not fair that he shows up, he's essentially a bit character who has no agency. He has one like slight part in the book Fulgrim and then dies. And then at least they give him some screen time down the line in the Primarchs. But Mark, you mentioned with some justice that it came too late to undo the damage that was done with Fulgrim. I would agree with this. I really think that Fulgrim should have been a two-part novel. Instead of the fifth book, should have been the sixth book. And Atrophy of the Eisenstein, there should have been a whole book by the Iron Hands. Because when else are they going to get a book? And we know the answer, never. I saw some Shattered Legion stuff and a novella in the Primarchs. So I think that's a solid point. And as to them being assholes, well, yeah, I agree 100%. nuking planets from orbit and just being unpleasant. I still don't feel that it's believable when Fulgrim goes to Ferris Manus and tries to convince him to join the War Master, mainly because his character wasn't developed well enough at that point. But George, I totally understand what you mean. It's like the Iron Hands of any of the chapters that remained loyalists, or the legions that remained loyalists, are the ones that probably would sympathize the most with the War Master. And you get this from Feet of Iron that we talked about last time too, when they were talking about, you know, all the legions are sort of asking themselves, like, what's going to happen to us after the Great Crusade? And most legions wonder if there's a place for them in the new Imperium. And the Iron Hands are asking themselves if there's a place for humanity in the new Imperium. It's like, why would he allow all these like weak people to live and shit? They're so much stronger and better than they are. It sounds like something Horace would say. So
yeah,
I genuinely agree with you, George. I think you strike a fucking solid point. Second thing was about the Demolisher cannon and weapons like the Typhon and the Vindicator. George was wondering if there was actually real world examples of tanks like that, or if something that Games Workshop invented. Can you think of any?
Me, no.
Okay, so this is, I'll pull out my historian, I'll put my historian hat on to answer the question. Weapons like the Typhon and the Vindicator are assault guns. They're not tanks. We have to make a distinction. You have to understand that after the Great War, the first appearance of actual tanks, people weren't sure what exactly tanks were going to be. Going forward, like what the role of a tank was, what is the nature of tank forces. In the interwar years before World War II, there were several schools of thought. The dominant one was that tanks needed to be specialized. Every tank needed to do one specific thing and do it well. So you had the British would name them, for example, infantry tanks. Infantry tanks were slow tanks like Matildas, which would keep up with the, which would support infantry attacks. Then you had cavalry tanks that would like exploit breakthroughs. The Germans and the French, for example, never really used that terminology. It was mainly light tanks and medium tanks with specific goals in mind. If you look at when the World War II started, the two main German tanks were the Panzer III and the Panzer IV. Those tanks were not an evolution. The Panzer III and the Panzer IV had two different roles in mind. The Panzer III was a tank that was fast and had a decent, at the time, anti-tank gun, which I think was a 37mm gun, which once they went up against French the heavy French tanks, they quickly realized that they were useless, and they were even more useless against Soviet T-34s and KV tanks. But the Panzer III was a fast tank that was meant to exploit breakthroughs and destroy other armor, whilst the Panzer IV was armed with a low-caliber 75mm, essentially a field gun with high-explosive rounds. If you look at early Panzer IVs, they have very short turrets. That's because they're meant for infantry support. So you have like these very specialized tank chassis that all have specific roles. Now, what is quickly realized is that a lot of these tank, these tanks, if you want to put a gun in a fully rotating turret in 1939, 1940, 1941, unless you're the Soviets in this particular case, you probably don't have enough room in the tank turret. So the easy solution to this is to remove the turret. For example, if you want to upgun a Panzer III, the easiest thing to do is just to remove the turret and then just stick a 75mm gun into it. And then you have the proliferation of a number of subcategories of tanks. Tanks are is a fully tracked vehicle with a turret. That is the definition of a tank. You have these subgenres of tanks, which are called assault guns and tank destroyers. And you see them, everybody's using them in World War II. Mainly the Germans, because they don't have a very good medium tank until the development of Panthers and Tigers. Well, Tigers are heavy tanks, but anyways. What I mean is like a multi-role tank. They don't really have, they have very specialized tanks. Tank destroyers are turretless vehicles, fully tracked vehicles, which are meant to destroy other tanks. Everybody's using them. Mainly they're armed with a 75mm high-velocity gun or something more powerful. Soviets have them. The most famous German examples are the Stug series of tanks, basically the Stug III, which is the most produced German tank of the war. They built like 10,000 of them, which is mainly used as a tank destroyer, but had also had a another version, which was an assault gun. An assault gun is usually a part of the artillery arm of a nation at war. An assault gun is a fully tracked vehicle with no turret, but a very, very powerful gun. Some famous examples, if you want to go on Google, is look up the Sturm Tiger. The Sturm Tiger is on a Tiger chassis, but it's got this like giant, it's like a giant fucking gun, right? And essentially an assault gun's main role would be to support an infantry attack. It would be able to lob higher, high explosive shells. It would be used to dislodge, for example, fortified like bunkers and stuff like that. It should be able to destroy a bunker. It would be used for essentially for supporting infantry assaults. So that's the role of an assault gun. And if you look at the Vindicator, if you look at the Typhon heavy siege tank, they're assault guns. They're not tanks. They're assault guns. They're made to support infantry assaults. They have a very powerful guns. They do not have turrets. They are fairly short-ranged. These are all characteristics of an assault gun. So yeah, you can look at the Sturm Tigers, for example. The Broom Bar is another example of an assault gun. If you look at these, they look like Vindicators or Typhons. They look the part. So to answer your question, George, if once again you've permitted me to put my historian hat on, essentially the answer to your question is James Workshop didn't invent anything. These vehicles that they produce have analogs in World War II. They're called assault guns. And if you look up, for example, Sturm Tiger, which is the best example, or Storm Tiger, I should say, it looks like a Vindicator. It totally does. So that's the role. Those are the real-world examples. Games Workshop didn't invent anything. By the end of the war, multi-purpose tanks became dominant, mainly through, for example, the Sherman, the M4 medium tank, the American version tank that the British called the Sherman, the Panther, German Panther, the T-34, the greatest tank of all time. Eventually, it was realized that a medium tank that had a good mix of firepower, mobility, and protection was the ideal. After the war, they stopped producing specialized tank designs and heavy tanks more generally, and almost all modern armies use some version of what's called a main battle tank, which, you know, Leopard 2 or I think the Centurion for the British, the M1 Abrams. They don't have specialized tank designs. This is a tank that can do everything. So modern armies use a single tank design that can do everything. If you look at World War II armies, they have just a myriad different classes that are very specialized. It's only towards the end of the war that they also go towards more generalist tank designs. So, George, I hope that answers your question, and thanks for letting me answer it. Mark, do you see anything wrong with any of my anything I said?
No.
Because you know this shit too, right?
To a degree, yeah.
Okay.
Maybe not as much detail as you do, but yeah.
Well, anyways, I hope it answers the question, and it was a fun question to answer. Do you have anything to add?
I do not.
Okay. So anyways, Vindicators and Typhons are assault guns and not tanks. If it doesn't have a turret, it's not a tank. So listen, I don't want to get into this. Oh, but...
So Malkador is not a tank?
The Malkador... No, it's got a it's still got a rotating turret. It's just in a casemate.
Gotcha.
No,
gotcha.
It's still okay. That's a tank, but a Typhon isn't. Malkador Defender is not a tank.
What about a Stormlord?
Stormlord is not a tank.
Even though it has last cannon turrets on the side.
Well, shit, yeah, it's because those tanks don't.
And the main gun's fixed.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess you could call it a tank if you want.
What about a Falcon? Is that a tank?
Falcon, is that the one... Does it have a turret or not? Does it have a fully rotating turret?
It does. Yeah, it's got a turret, fully rotating.
A tank. There's a tank.
Gotcha.
The Falcon that doesn't have a turret, that would be a tank destroyer.
Oh, the Fire Prism?
Not the Fire Prism, the Falcon. You know, the one Falcon? That fires... yeah, the one... which is the... there's one of those tanks, like one of those glaive chassis tanks that has a turret that doesn't move.
Oh, the Falcon, yeah.
Yeah, that would be a tank destroyer, I think.
Same thing with like a Storm Shadow Sword.
Yeah, Shadow Sword is a tank destroyer for sure. Well, it's a Titan destroyer, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, it doesn't have a fully rotating turret, so it's not a tank. By the way, this rule does not apply for the Great War. Let's just be clear. the British, you know, the Marks, Mark 1 and Mark 4 tanks, they're tanks, even though they don't have fully rotating turrets. The only tanks with fully rotating turrets in the Great War are the Renault FT tanks, the first true tanks. But what I'm talking about right now with all the separate definitions for different armored vehicles doesn't apply for the Great War. After the Great War, then you have tanks, tank destroyers, and assault guns.
Okay, I got one more for you. What about a Malkador Defender?
Malkador Defender is not a tank. It doesn't have a fully rotating turret.
Gotcha, okay.
It's a rolling bunker. It has no real analog, I don't think, except for it's a Great War tank, but it's just it's like a Mark IV female. You know what I'm talking about? The World War I Mark IV tanks or Mark I tanks? Mark II and Mark III tanks didn't really get produced very much, so it's mainly the Mark I and Mark IV that you see in action in the last years of the Great War. The British tanks, the ones with the treads that would go all the way around the tanks, those are classic tank designs that influenced everything in 40K.
Land Raiders, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. It's fucking... It's just a Land Raider, like, turned around. That's what the Mark IV is. If you look at how the tanks, like, how the treads are designed, it's just... To make the Land Raider, the Games Workshop just turned a Mark IV around. And or a Liberty tank, what would have been, I think, the Mark V. But essentially, they defined them as male and female tanks. Male tanks had like a 50 millimeter gun or something like that. It had like an artillery gun, and the female tanks had machine guns. Just had a bunch of machine guns, like four machine guns. Yeah, I think the Malkador, its analog is a female Mark IV. There's very few machine gun armed tanks outside of very light tanks until World War II. Like, you had like the Panzers 1 and 2, which had machine guns, and you had like some of the old fucking Soviet tanks that had machine guns. But tanks need a gun. Maybe I'm being unfair to machine gun armed tanks, but I don't think the Malkador Defender is a tank.
Gotcha.
Yeah, that's right. I'm saying it. Malkador Defender is not a tank, and I still love it. it's just a rolling bunker. So great.
Hells yeah.
Any other questions?
I'm trying to think of any other random weird things that could stump you on this.
All I'm doing is applying World War II definitions to Games Workshop vehicles. Like, you can stump me all you want. But anyways, George, I hope that answers the question. Thank you so much for sending all that stuff in. I totally agree, Ferris Manus. It does not get proper treatment in Fulgrim. It's just a shame the way that they were organized. He really needed his own book in the first couple. I don't know why they didn't. But what are you going to do? So I think that's good for VoxBox. Once again, we are soliciting people to send us audio files or audio messages that we can play on air. It's just so much more dynamic. It's so much more fun as a feedback segment. So send that shit our way. And if you don't want to, well, send us regular emails too, because we love talking to all of you. All of y'all. So we'll be right back for the 2-Copy Challenge. All right, welcome to the 2-Copy Challenge. Mark, it's a big day today.
It is. It's prize day.
It's prize day. Now, for those that that recall, we are running our year-long 2-Copy Challenge League, whereas everybody that participates in 2-Copy Challenges and succeeds in their 2-Copy Challenge, so everybody but me, will be entered into a prize draw. pretty much, you don't get to win either.
I know.
But here's the way it works. I have a master list of everybody's 2-Copy Challenges and everybody that succeeded. So we got about like 60 or 70 entries or something like that of successful 2-Copy Challenges in the last 3 months. So what we're going to do is we're going to randomly generate a number between 1 and whatever the final number was. And then we will count through and randomly select who will win a sweet prize. What's the sweet prize this time, Mark?
It is a pair of fancy apothecaries for some people.
Yep. We realize that everybody that has done the 2-Copy Challenges in the past 3 months have Astartes army. So we tried to pick something that would be useful for everybody. And you can't have enough apothecaries, especially now with the new books out. You can actually attach apothecaries to more units.
Hell yeah.
So the winner of this phase will win a pair of sweet apothecaries. So I think I explained the methodology, we explained what the prize is. Mark, would you like to randomly generate a number? You got any D10s on you?
I sure do. Between what and what?
Between 1 and, I believe, 65. So just re-roll if it's more than that.
Okay.
I thought you said you had D10s. I heard that's your, like, phone dice.
They're still dice.
I don't know, man. I don't trust machinery. I wish we had some real D10s. Why don't we have any D10s? Or one of those giant, like, fucking pool ball-sized D100s?
I don't have any of those, sadly.
All right, whatever. What number did you come up with?
33.
All right. I'm going to start counting. Okay. The winner of this phase of the 2-Copy Challenges is our old pal, Philip.
Oh, wow. Congratulations, Philip.
So Philip, who's been painting a bunch of stuff, we keep trying to get him to paint more militia. he always does. He is the winner of this phase of the 2-Copy Challenges.
Woohoo!
So Philip, when you listen to this, when you hear this, send us an email to say that you listened to it so we can, you know, it'll be a surprise. If I haven't heard from you in like a week or something like that, I'll contact you. And we can figure out how we can get you your sweet prize of a pair of apothecaries. So congratulations, Philip. Thank you for your participation in the 2-Copy Challenges. We're very much grateful. Anybody out there, if you guys want to participate in the 2-Copy Challenges, send them our way. And sometime in, I guess, October, you could win a sweet prize.
Sweet.
Next one's a Warlord Titan, right?
No.
But you could win a Warlord Titan if you actually buy raffle tickets for Freddy the Swede's raffle to benefit or to help the fight against Duchenne's disease.
That's correct, sir.
So in October, you could actually win a Warlord Titan. We're not the ones who are going to be giving it to you, though. But for those that haven't done that, check out, I think it's Heresy Against Duchenne's on Facebook, and definitely get some raffle tickets and hopefully buy it. Did you get raffle tickets?
I have not gotten any raffle tickets yet.
You're going to have to do that.
You're planning on it.
Yeah, it's a hell of a prize. And that's donated by a scattershot painting. We should really shout this out a little more often. I think we're going to start doing that. Okay, so Philip, you won a sweet prize. Everybody out there, participate in the 2-Copy Challenges, and you could be like Philip and the last winner, Graham, winning sweet prizes.
Woohoo!
Okay, that'll do it. What about this 2-Copy Challenge? Mark, what was your 2-Copy Challenge?
I was going to paint a knight errant.
And did you paint a knight errant?
I sure did.
Wicked. Is it the guy from Cybernetica?
No, it is not. He's dead, so.
The Carrion?
Yeah.
That's not clear.
I'm pretty sure he's dead.
Pretty sure he's dead.
Yeah.
So what's this guy's name?
I haven't figured that out yet.
Okay. Well, let me know.
Usually he has to do something really cool to get a name, but so far he hasn't seen a tabletop yet, so.
He hasn't seen a tabletop yet?
Not yet.
Okay. Well, let me know how he goes. What about the first guy, the Iron Warrior? Does he have a name yet?
Kurnax.
Kurnax?
Yeah.
I like it. That is a cool name.
He earned his name, so.
What did he do? He's the one who tanked a billion wounds, eh?
Yeah. And it all came down to killing him and made four up and vulnerable saves. Next turn, made 3 4 up and vulnerable saves. And they were all instant death, too, so I was super happy about that.
Cool. All right. Makes sense. Okay.
What did you do?
My two-week hobby challenge was to paint 5 militia.
Ooh. That's a toughie, eh?
Even though I'm also painting a Age of Sigmar set for my buddy's store to help him out. Try to get like a base set because there's a Age of Sigmar thing going on right now. So I'm painting some stuff for him. Even though I had to paint like a billion of those like blood guys. What are they called? The Marauders?
Blood Reavers?
Yeah, the Blood Reavers. So I painted a bunch of Blood Reavers and the new Chaos Warriors. The Blood Warriors?
Blood Warriors, yeah.
What's the icon bearer called again?
Blood Secretor.
The Blood Secretor, it's so goofy. But yeah. Even though I had to paint a bunch of those guys, I actually pulled up my sleeves and got 5 militia done as well.
No way.
I know. No box of shame for me.
So how many more militia do you have to paint now? 200 and what?
200, I don't know. Like I didn't last. I don't remember just how many there are. There's probably around 300. But I will get it done and it's slowly moving forward. It's just freaking a hell of a project. But yeah, I actually succeeded this time. Probably won't next time, but still.
Well, just aim low and you'll succeed.
Aim low. That's like the worst advice you could ever give to someone. Just aim low and you'll succeed. All right.
how did the listeners do this time, JP?
Sean will be working on a Zorn Mortalis Istvan board. He will be painting the board and assembling the bracers for the second half of the board.
Cool.
And he succeeded.
Nice.
Griex, I phrased that really, really poorly. He was supposed to do that, and he succeeded in doing that. Griex was going to be either completing his Legion champion or his command squad. He got the champion done, and it looks freaking gorgeous.
Cool.
Paul was supposed to go back to try to finish up his plastic card Spartan, which is a freaking awesome project and truly how you do 30K on a budget. He got that done.
Very cool.
Lots of progress on that one. It's coming along really, really beautifully. Philip was going to build 5 Sons of Horus Reavers and paint them to a tabletop standard. And this is to support his Escalation League. Don't forget, we're in the middle of the Horus Heresy Summer Escalation League. And he got that done.
Cool beans.
Robert was supposed to get 10 Flamers and 10 Meltasport Marines painted and on 32mm bases.
How'd that go?
Didn't go so well.
Oh, shame.
He did not succeed, so that's shame.
You go to the box and you feel shame.
Go to the box.
Hey, if you need a new sound clip for the shame, you should get the one from Game of Thrones.
What's that one? Oh, you mean when Cersei's getting...
That lady just falling around. Shame. Shame.
Oh, that's not a bad idea. Would that be better than the slapshot one I have?
Well, I don't know. You could mix it up.
You think I should mix it up? Okay, next episode, we'll give it a try, and then we'll let people decide whether or not they're sick of hearing the beginning of slapshot. Because I'm not. I'll never get sick of it, of hearing that. Keith was supposed to assemble the bottom part of his knight, so legs, hips, and cables. He was going to be leaving the armor plates off while he paints it. Now, this is supposed to be a sort of like an entry load of war for his Mechanicum Force, and he got that done.
Nice.
Damien was going to be fully finishing painting his Forge Lord and 3 Servitors. He's going to build and undercoat his 4th 2x1-foot Zorn Mortalis board section, which is a fucking really, really cool project. And he's going to build and repose his Kalth Contemptor Dreadnought. Wicked. I love people reposing those legs. I'm starting to get sick of every single table having like a gimpy leg fucking Kalth Contemptor. You know, the
or, legs. Or many of them.
Or many of them, yeah. But he got that done, which is amazing. Good awesome. On you, sir. And Graham was, for his next 2-week hobby challenge, sorry. Graham was going to assemble and prime a Khorne Bloodthirster for his Siege of Terra Khorne Demon's Army. And he got that done.
Very cool.
So, some great work by all of our friends out there. Mark, what is your next 2-week hobby challenge for the phase that will be running from the 16th of July to the 30th of July?
Is it okay if it's not heresy related?
No.
Oh, shit.
It can be tangentially related to the heresy.
Does priming count as related to the heresy?
If you want.
Cool. I'm priming up a shitload of models.
What are you priming?
Slaves to Darkness.
Slaves to Darkness.
Yeah.
Oh, are you working on Age of Sigmar?
I am.
Okay, Mark, I didn't count my Age of Sigmar project. You shouldn't count yours. You have nothing heresy related that you could do?
I don't have much left to paint for, Horus Heresy right now, man.
You have nothing you could do.
I've got a lightning and another knight errant.
Well, why don't you build a knight errant?
He's already built and primed and everything. Well, I guess I could paint him. Yeah, I'll paint him.
There you go. Mark is painting a third knight errant.
Okay.
Yeah. Should always have something here. Just one guy. You don't need to. It doesn't have to be paint the Stormhammer.
Wicked. So what are you doing, bud?
I'm going to paint another 5 militia. I think that's a realistic project. It worked last time, and I'm going to do it again.
If you fail, man, you're going to have to paint 3 next time. Then you'll definitely get it.
Yeah. I think 5 is good. I can do 5.
Okay. All right. 5 it is.
When I'm done all that Age of Sigmar stuff, I can ramp up the projects.
Awesome. So who's joining us this time?
This time, in this phase, again, running from the 16th to the 30th of July, Paul plans to get another Plastic Art Spartan started, and also a Typhon Siege Tank.
Mm, very nice.
So, yeah, that's going to be pretty awesome. He's going to have 2 Spartans and a Typhon in that army. That's just brutal.
Yeah.
Good luck finding friends after that. Although, I guess Spartans aren't as good as they were there now that flare shields are so expensive.
And they're more expensive, too. Yeah.
Graham is going to dynamically pose and assemble the legs and chest of his Imperial Knight, which is great. Because, again, just like the Contemptors, I'm sick of seeing stiff-legged knights everywhere. As a stretch goal, he wants to also do a second knight.
Cool.
Which is awesome. Griex has magnetized his command squad on jet bikes, and so in the next for his 2-week hobby challenge, he's going to be finishing painting all little details on the command squad, and also pretty much all the different options that are magnetized, like all the different weapons options and everything.
Cool.
So that's awesome. Dan, who is new to the 2-week hobby challenges, will be starting a set of Betrayal Kalth Terminators. He's going to try to get the brass etching and try to get them primed and get the base colors on them with his airbrush for his Night Lords project, which is awesome because we need more Night Lords.
Sweet.
There's never enough Night Lords on the table. So Dan, welcome to the 2-week hobby challenges, sir. Philip will be finishing painting 5 Death Guard tactical support and 2 apothecaries. Keith will be priming the upper torso of his knights, and he's going to start painting a base layer on them.
Cool.
Sean is going to be painting 3 more veterans, the Dreadnought, and a squad of support support flamers. And Damien will be fully painting his Contemptor. He's going to be fully painting a 4th 2x1 foot Soul Mortalis board, and he's going to build a Land Raider to deliver his Cataphracti into melee combat. Awesome.
Mm, sweet.
It's a lot of stuff, but I believe in him. Pretty much because he succeeded every other time. So those are the 2-week hobby challenges for this current phase. Good luck, everyone.
So, JP, what are you going to play us out to this time?
Oh, I got a good one today. I got a good one. Today, we will be closing out the show with one of my favorite thrash bands, underground thrash bands, Ghoul. And their song, Rise, Killbot, Rise.
That's awesome.
Which is an awesome song and very appropriate for the book that we talked about, which is what I like to aim for when choosing songs. Ghoul is one of my favorite fucking bands nowadays, active bands. And the best part is if you see them live, and you have to see Ghoul live, you will get splashed with some blood. That's just a fact. But if you see Ghoul live, when they play the song Rise, Killbot, Rise, they actually have a guy dressed as the Killbot, and he goes on stage and smashes people and shit.
Very cool.
So, and they fight the Killbot, because the Killbot needs to be defeated for humanity to prevail. So that's going to be Rise, Killbot Rise. Mark, what are we doing next time? This was a short one. The next episode will not be short, I don't think.
No, we'll be digging deep into the changes to the Legion book.
And then?
And after that, we will be talking about some world eaters, various world eater things. Voxbox, 2-week hobby challenge, as normal.
Absolutely. So, yeah, we're going to be doing how to paint the world eaters, and then we are going to be talking about the short stories After Dashia, Lord of the Red Sands, and Heart of the Conqueror. And we will be combining that with some of our other some other stuff. I'm trying to piece together to have a better understanding of who the world eaters are. And I think that's going to be a fun one.
It should be very entertaining.
It should be very entertaining. All right, so that was episode 34 of the Age of Darkness podcast. As usual, I'm JP.
I'm Mark.
And thanks for listening. Rise, Killbot, rise.